cyber attacks come in three different flavors, at least when it comes to figuring out who's behind the attack. That's according to Jay Healy, director of Cyber Statecraft, the Cyber Statecraft Initiative at the Atlantic Council. He's tweeting about the three flavors of cyber attribution. Jay, first of all, plugging your hashtag at Jason_Healy, and I follow you regularly, and I appreciate the information about cybersecurity you put out there. Thanks for being on the program today. What prompted you to generate the concept of cyber attribution in terms of flavors?
Well, we can make it very, very difficult. Something about a lot of us that work cybersecurity, we like a lot of tribes out there, make it try and seem like magic what we do and make it seem very confusing for outsiders. But really, most of the evidence when there's a cyber attack, it boils down to one of three different kinds of ways that we're figuring out who it was. So why not call them flavors?
I appreciate the fact that you framed this in very easy to understand ways. Of course, I guess you're limited by 140 characters, so you gotta make it somewhat simple. But I'm going to take these in countdown style. The third one that you wrote about was the context of the attack. And you write, Smart Money says, if Estonia gets whomped during a crisis with Russia, it's likely Russia. Why is it that maybe sometimes we're a little bit apprehensive about making the obvious connections like that?
Well, this rule of thumb, if we want to call it, works best when you're really looking at a disruptive attack. And the more disruptive the attack, the more likely that the geopolitical context is going to help. So, for example, when China gets into a dust-up with its neighbors in the South China Sea, you know those neighbors are going to start being hit by denial-of-service attacks. Now, maybe there's Spectre out there that, you know, Spectre is always trying to get Russia and the Soviet Union and the U.S. to fight one another. Mm-hmm. I can never figure out why. But you can bet, more often than not, that it's really the Chinese that are hitting the Filipinos or the U.S. or the Japan or whoever China's angry with at that point.
I asked a lot of people after a Target and after Sony, why is it so important that we attribute attacks in the first place? I guess that question's kind of been overcome by events in the North Korea situation, because it's obviously important why we understand what happened there. But are you seeing more of an interest in attribution and understanding it, or less of an interest, or different interest? Or what's that landscape look like, Jay?
Well, there have been some great companies, including some located in D.C., companies like Mandiant or CrowdStrike, that have been trying to tell us that knowing who's tormenting you can help you develop ways to defeat them. So certainly when Sony came about, now all of a sudden people are saying, yes, I can understand why knowing who's responsible for this can is really critical in figuring out how we can make it stop and getting around it.
The second flavor of attribution that you tweeted about, Jay, is familiarity. And you wrote, Danny Ocean and Night Fox each steal with signature style. NK, North Korea, use signature infrastructure on Sony. Is it that easy? Are these various types of attacks that clearly signed, the way I'd sign my name on something?
Sometimes. I came into this field from signals intelligence, and my operators could tell by the way someone sent Morse code who was who. They would have a different hand, they called it, different fist, and you could tell who would do what. And we can tell in some of the attacks, you know, especially the companies that really specialize in this, they know when you do this kind of attack, when you use this infrastructure, that's a signature. I almost said a fingerprint, but that makes it sound too scientific and precise. And these are all rules of thumb. For example, the attacks on Georgia in 2008, a lot of those attacks trace back to Russian organized crime, which really helps you figure out, all right, you know, that helps bolster the case that this was either supported by Moscow or they knew it was going on and they let it happen.
Right. And then it becomes more of an intelligence gathering exercise to figure out that last mile rather than starting completely from scratch and trying to figure it out. But just as I can learn how to sign somebody else's name, not that I ever did it in high school or anything, can't somebody who's perpetrating an attack figure out a way to make that signature look different?
It's certainly possible that you can do that. In the Sony attack, there was attack infrastructure that we knew the North Koreans used. Now, someone else would have to know what that was, take that infrastructure over, hijack it for their own purposes, and then do this just to make North Korea look bad. Now, that's possible. But the more you string together like this, the less likely it becomes, right?
And I wasn't even thinking about trying to fake somebody out so much as just disguise my own identity and not my identity, but the identity of the perpetrator of the attack. Jay Healy's director of the Cyber Statecraft Initiative at the Atlantic Council and tweeting about the three flavors of attributions of cyber attacks. The last one or the first one, depending which way you're counting, is that clues hidden in malware or an attack, such as time of day when attacks occur or language settings. What do you mean by language settings in that one, Jay?
Yeah, well, for the real digital forensic specialist, they will look at attacks, the malicious software, and they can pull it apart and figure out what got used, what happened at this crime scene, just like you would look at the caliber of a bullet and be able to figure out, did this come from, is this likely an American-made weapon or a Russian-made weapon? They can go in and find out what time of day was the code compiled. Was this created on a Korean keyboard, or was this, that was set up to look for Korean characters or for English characters? Again, these are signals that can be faked, but they can only be faked with difficulty. So, each one of these flavors, it gives you a rule of thumb. So the more you start seeing the evidence add up across these, was this taking place between, did this attack happen when two countries were really angry with each other? Are we seeing them use a style that we just know who this is likely to be? Are we seeing evidence in the code itself? All of that really helps you lead towards putting the flavors together and guessing who it is that was behind this.
Jay, what is the current trajectory or progression of attribution science? Is that progression happening as fast as the threat landscape is evolving, or do the people who are trying to do attribution, are they falling behind?
It's one of the few places that the defense is actually getting better faster than the attackers are. We have been getting much, much better at figuring out who's behind this than they are at hiding their tracks. In almost all the areas, the attackers still have the advantage. But again, if you're talking to some of these companies, Mandiant, CrowdStrike are in the lead here, or some of the folks that are in the intelligence community. And what's happening in the private sector is every bit as good as what's happening in the intelligence community. You're really getting people to speak with much more confidence that they're able to get around with this. Now, the problem for that, on one hand, it's great, we're solving attribution. Now, the downside is we've been talking about how difficult attribution is. We haven't said, what do you do when the dog catches the car, right? All of a sudden, now we've got to think, what policies do we need based on what somebody's done to us? Now that we know who it is, what do we do about it?
Well, that's probably nowhere more pronounced than at the Department of Defense right now, right, Jay?
Oof. Yep, absolutely. And now I'll tell you, what we didn't do in response to North Korea is counterattack the North Korean internet. I am very, very confident that the North Korean internet going down was not a United States counterattack. That wasn't us.
Why do you say that? What were the traits of that outage that you thought made it not us?
One is not our fingerprint. They've only got a very, very tiny internet. And we like the cool, sophisticated hacks. We like the Stuxnet. We would have preferred to sit on that and see what they're doing, collect intelligence rather than take it down. But more importantly, the U.S. and the president are committed to free speech. And to take down another country's internet with a denial of service attack really goes against what we've been saying in those areas. I don't think we would have taken that shot. But what really wins it over is that those connections are in China. Can you imagine being the president? You're about to go on vacation. You want to get in some golf. And all of a sudden, you're going to authorize an attack on Chinese sovereignty just so you can take down 1,000 North Korean internet addresses. No way we would have taken that shot.
That's an interesting perspective that I hadn't heard other places, and it's very logical, Jay. Last question, disconnected from your three flavors of attribution. We're going to link to your Twitter feed at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth. I am hearing a growing group of people, not all in the federal government, but some, saying that the mindset about what you do when you find somebody has compromised your network and they're still in it is changing. Oh. That the idea that we let these people knock around a little bit and to be able to watch them and see how they're doing it and what they're trying to accomplish rather than cutting off access immediately is starting to gain more prominence. What do you think about that? Good idea or bad, Jay?
If you can accept the risk, it's a good idea. I think in 2015, one of the trends is you'll be hearing a lot more about response than protection. Also to watch in 2015 is Russia and Iran.